You know, we are, if elected president, going to invest a lot of money into mental health. And when you watch these Republican debates, you know why we need to invest in mental health.
Ain't it true?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. To the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast and 106.7 FM KSO in Cozy Cottage Grove. Out in Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster. Out in Hawaii, where they are having Republican caucuses today on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. And up in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Coast to coast and blanketing the globe. Streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio. Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville. Detour Talk in East Tennessee, and of course, Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. The good news, today's interview on the Bradcast will be a welcome and much-needed break from presidential politics, even as voters head to the polls today to vote in the great states of Mississippi and Michigan, and for Republicans only in Idaho and Hawaii. The bad news: this week marks the fifth anniversary of the triple disaster earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster which struck Japan in March of 2011, so the interview will relate to that. So, you know, a mix of good and bad. Speaking of a mix of good and bad news, hello, Desi Doyen.
Hey.
I don't even know what that means.
I'll take it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I tell you, Des, I recall watching live on CNN 5 years ago, which seems both like yesterday and forever ago, as the sea, remember this? As the sea overtook parts of eastern Japan.
Yes, it was happening in the middle of the day in Japan, and they had news helicopters that were out there watching and tracking this massive tsunami as it came and swept across northeastern Japan.
Yeah, we saw that live
as it happened.
Swept in. Folks on the East Coast, it was very, very late on the East Coast. I think it was about 2 a.m. out here in California, if I recall correctly. And then I can't recall if it was on Twitter or where it was, as I was following this, as I was covering it at bradblog.com, as it was ongoing, we got the news about some kind of explosion at a nuclear plant in the Fukushima prefecture. And I it was amazing because that was one of the first things that, came up, questions about the nuclear plants. And I think they had at the time about 44 different plants around Japan. And most of them, I think, had been shut down immediately from the earthquake or whatever procedure that they go into after an earthquake.
Yeah,
it's not a shutdown, right?
Yes, they do. Actually, they have an automatic trigger shutdown that occurs at all nuclear power plants in Japan. That's what they did.
But, of course, that doesn't relieve the danger of the nuclear fuel these reactors. It takes some time to shut them down. And there was that word of that explosion. We were trying to figure out what it was. It was a hydrogen explosion that had built up in the plant. Folks know what happened thereafter. At least we have some idea of what happened thereafter. We still don't have the full story. And the company that runs the plant still runs it to this day. Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, has still been less than forthcoming, it seems to me, about what actually went on and what actually continues to go on today. Some 18,000 subsequently died, not from the nuclear disaster there, but from the earthquake and the tsunami. They are 18,000 died, still listed as missing from that triple disaster. And the nuclear disaster itself at Fukushima Daiichi still continues to this day. We spoke just hours after the disaster with Steve Herman. I was following him that night because there was a lot of reports. As I said, folks on the East Coast out here were asleep. But those of us on the West Coast sort of got to jump on this story. And I recall, you know, listening to Japanese news sources at the time on Twitter, which was incredibly valuable that night. Reporters in Japan were doing a great job of covering the story. One of them was Steve Herman. Fantastic job covering it for Voice of America News. He was their Northeast Asia Bureau Chief at the time. He's now VOA's Bangkok Bureau Chief, and we will talk to him in Bangkok momentarily, as we did just hours after the original disaster. We'll talk to him again about what he reports now is a continuing, ongoing, and in some ways getting worse nuclear disaster at that now crippled plant in Japan, where as many as four reactors are believed to have melted down as we mark the five-year anniversary of that continuing disaster. So see what I mean about the good news and bad? Now you miss the presidential stuff, don't you?
Surely
see?
You want to say something about Trump in there somewhere,
see?
Right?
I know,
sort of lighten
see?
Things up a little.
Be careful what you wish for. Well, we got a little bit of that before we turn to Steve Herman in Bangkok. There are primaries being held today in Michigan, in Mississippi, as I said, for both Republicans and Democrats, in Idaho and Hawaii. In Idaho, it's a primary for Republicans only. In Hawaii, it's a caucus for Republicans only. So those numbers will come in very, very late tonight. We'll talk about all of those results, no doubt, on tomorrow's broadcast. We have been talking, yesterday I spoke about the results from Super Saturday, or the Super Saturday weekend that took place. But we've been talking for the last week or two about the way that the corporate media has been reporting the delegate counts on the Democratic side, where they've got these super delegates, as they refer to them. What they are is unpledged delegates, delegates who have not yet voted, delegates who are actually party insiders and elected officials and so forth. They don't have to cast their vote. They won't cast their vote for either Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton until the conventions this summer. And yet some of these super delegates have spoken to the media and said, yeah, I support Hillary, or I support Bernie Sanders. Many more of them supporting Hillary Clinton. But their votes are not set in stone. They are not pledged delegates like the bulk of the delegates that people are actually voting for right now in places like Michigan and Mississippi and so forth. By the way, the good news in Michigan, they use paper ballots for most of the state. So if there's any question about the results, we may be able to figure out who actually won or lost. Not necessarily the case in Mississippi, where that state continues to hate their voters so much they force almost all of them to vote on 100% unverifiable touchscreens across the state. So if there's any question about the results, yeah, probably won't be able to figure it out. Now you know. Because nobody else tells you other than the broadcast, apparently. But anyway, going back to the weekend. So I noted that over the weekend, Bernie Sanders won not only three of the four states that were up having nominating contests in Kansas, Nebraska, and Maine, where Bernie Sanders won. Those were caucus states. Hillary Clinton reportedly won the Louisiana primary. But in the end, Bernie ended up winning more delegates than Hillary Clinton. Now, yesterday I gave you the number. This was just over the weekend. So he got 67 delegates. Hillary got 65 delegates. That's according to Google's delegate tracker. Other delegate trackers are a little bit different over at Real Clear Politics. They're reporting for Super Saturday weekend that it was Bernie getting 64, Hillary getting 62. In any event, in both cases, Bernie won the weekend, and he beat Hillary in the delegate count by two delegates, which is, you know, for all intents and purposes, that's a tie. But Bernie came out ahead of Hillary and also in the states, 3 out of 4 states. And yet the way the media continues to report it is that Hillary is trouncing Bernie, that Bernie has no chance. He can't come back. Now she is beating him in the actual pledged delegates by just about 187. Now, today alone in Michigan and Mississippi combined, there are 166 delegates up for grabs. Next Tuesday, there are more than almost 700 delegates combined between Florida and Illinois and Missouri and North Carolina and Ohio. So, you know, she has a lead, but this is anything but over. The voters in the bulk of the country have yet to speak. And yet I've been highlighting, as we've been talking over the past week or so, New York Times, Washington Post, AP, Google, they are all reporting the delegates, the total delegate count, even including the non-committed, non-pledged so-called superdelegates. And if you look at that number, well, it looks like Bernie doesn't have a chance. If you look at the actual number of delegates that people have voted for after the weekend, it was 658 for Hillary, 471 for Bernie. Again, 187 delegate lead, but compared to the number of voters that remain out there to vote, anything but insurmountable. At least it would seem to me. But it's not just the corporate media, it's not just New York Times, Washington Post, AP, Google, etc. Even MSNBC is reporting it that way. Now, I don't have any reason to believe here necessarily that Rachel Maddow is trying to put her thumb on the scale, that she is in the tank for Hillary Clinton. And yet that is clearly the result when you look at the way that she is reporting on this race. I don't understand this. It seems like my job as someone in the media is to help inform the electorate. That seems to me my only job, in fact. That seems to me why I have constitutional dispensation for freedom of the press, to inform the electorate. Not to, you know, push them necessarily one way or another. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But when we're talking about the mainstream corporate media and the straight reporting here was Rachel Maddow last night talking about the weekend, talking about the Super Saturday weekend. And remember now, Hillary does lead by 187 delegates, but you have to the winner needs 2,383. And we're talking about right now 187 delegate difference between the two of them. And yet here was Rachel Maddow last night on her show.
On the Democratic side, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders continues to trail mightily in the delegate count, even as he keeps winning states across the country. But when you look at their overall progress toward the nomination, that's about delegates. And this was the delegate haul for those two candidates this weekend.
Okay, stop it there for a second. So this was the delegate haul for the weekend. She's talking about Super Saturday weekend, which Bernie won by any count I can find, won the delegate count by 2 delegates. Rachel Maddow puts up a graphic showing that Hillary Clinton actually won the weekend with 76 delegates to Sanders' 64 delegates. She beat him by 12 delegates, according to Rachel Maddow's big old graphic. And there was no separation between the real delegates and the so-called super delegates, who I would dare them, if they head into that convention this summer. In, where are they, North Carolina or something this year? If they head into that convention and Bernie Sanders has a majority of the voted for committed delegates, are you telling me that these party insiders are all going to vote for Hillary Clinton and take it away from the people? I don't know. Maybe they would. Maybe they would. But frankly, that's their problem, not ours, not our job in the media, to put the thumb on the scale in that way. And that was... That was Rachel Maddow doing it in favor of Hillary, saying that she beat Bernie Sanders by 12 delegates. Well, no, she actually lost by 2 delegates. The other ones are just, you know, elected officials and insiders who went and told AP or somebody, yeah, I support Hillary. I endorse her. She went on to do that not only for the weekend haul that she said was all about delegates, but also for the delegate count overall.
And this is the daunting delegate lead that Secretary Clinton holds over Senator Sanders overall.
The daunting delegate lead. And she went on to show more than 1,000 for Clinton and 477 for Bernie Sanders, which is different than the numbers I have. But in any event, a seemingly insurmountable 615 delegate lead, according to Rachel Maddow. So that's what's going on in the mainstream media. And again, you know, when I talk about this, it may sound like I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, that I'm trying to push you to vote for. No, I'm not. I've done this for other people as well. I've, you know, done this in past elections. When the media is misreporting what is going on, when they are, for whatever reason, putting their thumb on the scale, whether it was for Ron Paul back in 2012 or 2008, I covered it. I'm trying to even that imbalance that the corporate mainstream, Dennis Kucinich, you know, again, these candidates who are not taken seriously for whatever reason by the corporate media, despite the fact that voters haven't even had a chance to ring in on it. I think it's crazy. I think it's stupid, especially with something like this race between Hillary and Bernie. When you look at what the results would be this this November if they went head to head, at least according to the polls we have, if they went head to head with Donald Trump or Hillary or with Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. We've got new numbers in that regard in Michigan alone. Hillary going head to head against Ted Cruz defeats Ted Cruz by 7 points. That's pretty good. Sanders, on the other hand, beats him by 8 points, beats Ted Cruz by 8 points, according to this Wall Street Journal NBC poll for Michigan. Hillary beats Donald Trump only by 6 points. Yet Bernie Sanders beats Donald Trump by 12 points. So again, the electability argument still seems to be in question when it comes to Hillary Clinton. So why are they doing this? I don't know. I will let you, we report, you decide. You know, I have no evidence why this MSNBC corporation seems to be helping out, or at least Rachel Maddow in this case seems to be helping out Hillary Clinton in the way they're reporting it. But yes, the way you report stuff does make a difference. Now, despite that, and despite Democrats for so long telling us that, you know, oh, they'd love to go up against Donald Trump, they are finally beginning to echo what we've been saying on this show for months, that be careful what you wish for. You know, if you're excited about Trump becoming the 2016 nominee, you ought to be careful. And Democrats are now finally beginning to figure that out, according to Mike Lillis over at The Hill, who quotes a number of Democrats saying, finally, yeah, we should never take Trump lightly. And I do think that he has an appeal to independents and blue collar Democrats, especially that was Congressman John Larson, Democrat of Connecticut. Former head of the House Democratic Caucus. Anyway, they are beginning to get it. I'll try to get to more of this perhaps on tomorrow's show, and I hope we'll be able to take some callers on this. Fox News claims they're fair and balanced. We are actually trying to add some balance to this process in our reporting. All right. A quick break, and we will come back with Steve Herman from Bangkok about the ongoing Fukushima nuclear disaster. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Japan's prime minister at the time of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami, Naoto Kan, recently revealed that the country came within a paper-thin margin Those are his words, of a nuclear disaster requiring the evacuation of 50 million people, according to Britain's Telegraph recently. They report that in an interview to mark the fifth anniversary of the tragedy, which is this week, Khan described the panic and disarray at the highest levels of the Japanese government as it fought to control multiple meltdowns at the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station. He said he considered evacuating the capital, Tokyo, along with all other areas within 160 miles of the crippled plant, and declaring martial law. The future existence of Japan as a whole was at stake, he said. Something on that scale, an evacuation of 50 million, he said it would have been like losing a huge war. Khan admitted he was frightened and said he got no clear information out of the Tokyo Electric and Power Company, otherwise known as TEPCO, the plant's operator, and that he was, quote, very shocked by the performance of his own government's key nuclear safety advisor. Quote, we questioned him and he was unable to give clear responses, he said. We asked him, do you know anything about nuclear issues? And he said, no, I majored in economics. More than 18,000 are confirmed to have died or are still listed as missing from the 2011 quake and subsequent tsunami. And the nuclear disaster still remains for tens of thousands of residents of the Fukushima prefecture within 50 miles of the crippled nuclear plant. Writing at Voice of America News, Stephen L. Herman recently reported that experts say Japan's nuclear energy problems are worsening 5 years after a massive quake unleashed a tsunami that melted down the island nation's nuclear reactors. 9 million cubic meters of radioactive waste, much of its soil, are stored unsheltered in black bags throughout Fukushima, preventing tens of thousands of residents from returning home. And the problem is going to worsen before it improves, Herman reports for VOA. An estimated 13 million cubic meters of toxic soil is yet to be collected, and technicians have yet to solve the contamination issue inside the Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant. Government and industry officials acknowledge cleaning everything up, including decommissioning the crippled reactors, will take at least another 40 years and cost as much as $250 billion. And that timeline and the costs, reports Herman, considered overly optimistic by some industry experts, are based on nothing major going wrong. Herman writes that if another major earthquake hits and results in a tsunami, there will be a major setbacks. This is according to the nuclear plant's current manager, Akira Ono. Thousands of workers are dedicated to keeping under control the plant's six reactors, four of which melted down or were severely damaged. Japan has never decommissioned a nuclear reactor, much less reactors as damaged as those at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, and has resisted offers from foreign companies, even to this day, to help formulate an adequate cleanup plan, according to Voice of America. Joining us now is Stephen L. Herman. He's an American correspondent, originally hailing from Ohio, but who has lived in Asia since 1990. He is currently the Voice of America's bureau chief in Bangkok, reporting on the South and Southeast Asia regions. As a journalist, he's logged well over 1 million miles and visited 69 countries and territories. We spoke to Steve here on the broadcast just days, might have even been just hours, I can't recall now, after the triple disasters of that record 9.0 magnitude quake and 45-foot high tsunami and nuclear meltdown struck Japan 5 years ago this week in March of 2011. At the time, Steve was VOA's Northeast Asia bureau chief. He was based in Seoul, covering the Korean Peninsula and Japan. He was one of the few reporters, as I recall at the time, to actually visit the Fukushima prefecture not long after its initial evacuation, which continues in many areas for miles around the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant until this day. Stephen L. Herman, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Brad, great to talk to you again.
So good to have you here. 5 years later, it doesn't actually seem that long, but I covered it very closely at the time, as I know that you did. But in looking back today and putting together my notes, I realized that I was focusing so much on the nuclear disaster at the time that I'm actually a bit foggy on the timeline of what actually happened in the timeline following the quake and the tsunami and the meltdown and the evacuation, the creation of that 50-mile exclusion zone around the nuclear plant. Do you recall how long, Steve, after the initial disaster that the evacuation actually happened and the towns and the villages in the area, did they have any time at all to clean up from the earthquake and the tsunami before they were evacuated? Or were bodies and everything else still left there at the time that residents had to flee?
Well, the areas where the quake caused, or the tsunami actually caused the most damage, wiping out villages, that was a little farther north of the areas that were evacuated. So there was some earthquake damage in Fukushima Prefecture, but it was Miyagi Prefecture that bore the brunt of the tsunami. So they were focused on the quake, and then in Fukushima, as word came in of ominous trouble at the nuclear power plant, the focus shifted. In fact, we were on the ground, I think, just about 24 hours after the quake struck in Fukushima. We got the last flight into Fukushima Prefecture, and when we were boarding that flight from Osaka, they were contemplating canceling the flight because of concerns about a possible meltdown of the nuclear power plant. So by March 12th, there were already strong concerns, and then in subsequent days, we saw more alarms being sounded about the situation at Fukushima 1.
So there were no, it was not the case that there was, you know, bodies and rubble still left in place in some of these villages. Those villages were all outside of the exclusion zone. So we don't have bodies sitting there 5 years later, to my knowledge, do we?
No, there's nothing like that. Okay. And even in the communities closest to the nuclear power plant, people have been permitted to return to their homes for periods of time. And in some communities, I just read about one community near the plant, approximately 6% of the population has returned. They spend time there during the day and then leave at night. Older people don't have the strong concerns about the radiation exposure that, say, a young family with little children would have living in these communities for years. And a lot of these people were farmers. They had crops, they had cattle, and so for them to leave these areas, it was a total loss for them, even if their properties weren't damaged by the quake.
Now, are there still towns, some villages, I think I recall reading, that are still off limits, are still part of an exclusion zone around 12 miles or so from the plant? Are those towns still off limit to your knowledge? And if so, does that mean that basically these towns are sitting there sort of frozen in time from 5 years ago, dishes still in the sink and so forth, as we saw in some of the area around Chernobyl after that meltdown?
I've been to Chernobyl, and it is extremely eerie there because that place was absolutely frozen in time. And people were essentially told to leave and were never permitted to go back. But in the Fukushima exclusion zone, families have been able to return for periods of time. Mm-hmm. And there are some stubborn people who have gone back or never left. Some elderly people said, you know, I'm 82 years old, and very pragmatically said, by the time anything, you know, from radiation's going to, you know, affect me, something else is going to kill me before that. But obviously there are communities where it still does look like a ghost town in this 20-kilometer exclusion zone. But there is partial life, I would say, within the exclusion zone. In some communities now, people have been permitted to go back. So it's a very mixed picture.
So that was not a mandatory evacuation. Some people chose to stay throughout that disaster.
Yes, it was essentially mandatory, but the Japanese authorities did not go in and physically remove the the small number of mostly elderly people who decided for one reason or another to stay behind. But I would say 99.99% of the people did leave the exclusion zone temporarily or permanently.
Steve Herman, your recent article on the continuing problems at Fukushima describes 4 of 6 reactors which either melted down or were severely damaged. Do we know definitively at this point, 5 years later, how many of those reactors actually melted down and breached their, the concrete and steel encasements? Go ahead.
Definitely three of the reactors. And I can tell you something that I wasn't able to talk about at the time. I did have a source while I was in Fukushima, a source from another Japanese utility that had nuclear power plants, who told me during that week of March 11th that 3 of the reactors had melted down, but it was a single source. I couldn't get a second source on that, so I didn't put that on the air. At the time, we sort of erred on the side of caution on that. But it's been known from very early on that 3 of those reactors, were melted down, and we're talking core level. And hence, that is the problem on the site, that you have this cleanup effort that is going to last decades and cost hundreds of billions of dollars. 40 years is the official estimate, costs around $250 billion, but you talk to a lot of people and who are experts in the field, and they say that is a very optimistic figure. It's probably going to take much longer and cost much more, and the burden of this being borne by the Japanese taxpayers.
One of the reasons I'm kind of confused even to this day about how many of them actually melted down is because even now, the reporting seems to be unclear, and I see different numbers, and it seems like they're still at best guessing it. Is that because TEPCO is still, that it's too hot to go in there and confirm these numbers, and they're allowed to be vague at this point?
You can't. Physically, no one can go in the reactor rooms. There have been some robots with cameras that have been sent in to some of the buildings inside, but to try to shield this equipment properly so that even the video transmission systems will work is extremely challenging. I think there's definitely the assumption of the worst case scenario with 3 or 4 of the reactors. I think there's a question mark about the exact condition of the 4th reactor. And basically, the plan is just to contain the situation, deal with keeping everything cool, working on decommissioning process as prudently as possible. We just had some statistics the other day come out that 32,000 workers received an annual dose of 5 millisieverts at the plant. That's considered the leukemia compensation threshold. 174 of those workers had an annual dose of 100 millisieverts, which is believed to increase your risk of dying by cancer by 0.5%, and then there was one worker who actually received a dose of about 5 times that particular risk threshold. So it is a dangerous work, and they have to proceed very prudently. And it's going to go on for years and years, decades, actually.
Yeah, to say the least. You described that even after 5 years now, after the disaster, there seems to be no real cleanup plan for how to dispose of all the contaminated fuel and soil and water that continues to pile up. But does that mean that new soil, new water is being contaminated still every day? Or is this a matter of just pulling out what is, what was initially contaminated after the disaster? In other words, is this ongoing, not just the cleanup, but the continuing contamination? Is that still going on each and every day out there?
Yes, you have water, and then you have the soil, and the soil itself is being collected outside the premises of the nuclear power plant. 9 million cubic meters of radioactive waste are stored on shelter in these black bags, as you mentioned from my story, mm-hmm. throughout the prefecture. And then it's estimated there's another 13 million cubic meters of toxic soil that's been yet to be collected. And then you have these barrels with the radioactive water that are also on site. Some of that has been discharged into the ocean, and there are processes to get the water to levels that are not of extreme concern. But there is a continuing buildup of more stored water. And one consultant I talked to, an American, a former U.S. diplomat, says that Tokyo Electric Power can't decide what to do with all of it, and they refuse to let any foreign experience program management companies come in and help them out with this. Companies that haven't had experience with decommissioning nuclear power plants in other countries. So there is somewhat of a sense of a stubbornness by Japan to keep this all in the closed system, in its notorious nuclear village, as anti-nuclear groups would call it.
Is that a stubbornness within Japan, or is it TEPCO? In other words, is TEPCO a separate entity from the Japanese government? I mean, they're a private company, as I understand it. So what exactly right. is the relationship between the two, and why hasn't the government simply taken over the entire project at this point, given the continuing failures demonstrated by TEPCO? Why is this up to them at all as far as how this will be cleaned up? Who is making these decisions, Japan or TEPCO?
Well, yeah, there is a very tight and long-term relationship involving Tokyo Electric Power, part of the so-called nuclear village, with very large and powerful Japanese corporations who are major contributors to the political parties in Japan, namely the Liberal Democratic Party, which is actually the Conservative Party, which is in power right now. They also have a tremendous influence over the media as well. There's been a lot of criticism that there is this nexus of information control and also controlling all the work to keep it within these organizations. And as I said, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of spending that's going to occur over many decades. So you could say that this is actually a very, very lucrative industry in its own, just talking about the cleanup effort. There are obviously people that are very critical of these sort of procedures in this information control.
And I want to ask a little bit more about the government, but you write also, Steve, that even if Fukushima residents with homes inside the exclusion zone are allowed to return, that thousands of bags of radioactive soil in the prefecture may give them pause. And then you go on to describe what must be a typo. You say that at this point, the debris is being stored at 115,000 different locations. Did you have that right?
That is, yeah. So we've triple checked that figure. That is that is absolutely right, because there's no interim facility to store all of these. They're planning to build an interim facility that would cover 16 square kilometers in two towns close to the nuclear power plant. But of course, nobody wants to have that next to their towns and then moving all of this. There is still a sense of going very slow, or some critics might say almost a paralysis in dealing with this issue. It is just a daunting task. And
incredible.
It does seem incredible to a lot of people that there has not been more progress. But you have to understand, when we're talking about the scale of contaminated soil, just how careful they really should be, and the amount of people that would be needed and the amount of land to take care of this. And eventually they're supposed to move this out of Fukushima to another prefecture, but I think realistically that may be decades away, if ever, because you can only imagine what other areas would think of having all of this radioactive soil coming into their communities.
Now, after not long after the disaster, the Japanese government, under Naoto Kan, I believe, had decided to decommission all of the nation's, I believe, 43 other nuclear power plants, the ones that were still working. But a few years later, after the new prime minister came to power, Shinzo Abe, he vowed to restart those plants. How many have now been restarted? And is the long-term plan to move the nation entirely away from nuclear? Is that no longer the plan at this point?
Well, we have three reactors that have restarted. And as you note, the current government of Prime Minister Abe has taken quite a different course from Prime Minister Kan, who was with a different party, who was in power at the time of the disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And there is definitely a cautious attitude about restarting these reactors, but there's no doubt that nuclear energy is definitely in the mix. There are plans to allow operators to operate plants beyond 40 years, provided that they take measures for meeting certain requirements. And Japan, I think, is still looking to have about 20% of its power come from nuclear plants in the year 2030. That's the plan that's still on the books, and we expect that by this time next year, there will be between 6 and 12 more nuclear plants that will resume commercial operations.
I'm speaking with Stephen L. Herman of Voice of America News on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown disaster. Steve, a number of TEPCO executives were finally recently indicted. What were they charged with, and frankly, what took so long to charge them? Is this also part and parcel of the close relationship between the Japanese government and the power company?
Well, what happened was that prosecutors decided not to indict any company executives, but that decision was overturned by an independent citizens judicial panel, a very unusual process in Japan. We don't see it occurring that much. And that citizens panel mandated that three executives be charged on the grounds of not foreseeing the risks of a major tsunami prior to the disaster. And so they have been indicted. In Japan, once you're indicted, there is a very high rate of a conviction. So they are facing charges of professional negligence resulting in death and injury. They're former executives now, but they included the man, Sunehisa Katsumata, who was the chairman of TEPCO in 2011, and then two former vice presidents. 14,000 Japanese citizens filed the lawsuit against TEPCO officials, accusing them of ignoring research and not taking the necessary steps to prevent the catastrophe. So this is going to wind its way through the legal process. Mm-hmm. And most observers would say that convictions are almost inevitable, but we're probably talking about a process of some years for this to go through the legal system.
And does that include those people who were indicted? Does that include the people at this point that the citizens of Japan feel should be held accountable, or is there still accountability sought for, you know, members of the government and other members of TEPCO?
I think the focus will really be on the trial of these three executives. I cannot foresee that based on what's happened in the last 5 years since the catastrophe, that all of a sudden we're going to see a prosecutor somewhere go after other officials or members of the government, the focus will really be on these three TEPCO executives.
Do we know how stable the remaining six nuclear reactors actually are at this point? In other words, are they in danger of blowing up, or have they been? Are they generally stable? Are they still being constantly cooled by water as they were seawater? Are they still pouring seawater on these things as they were for some time after the initial disaster?
Right. Yeah, that is the key. That is, there is an ongoing process to keep these reactors stable. Or four of them are either suffered meltdowns, or three of them definitely suffered meltdowns. One more is totally damaged and may have also had a meltdown as well. And then you have two other reactors on site that are just much easier to be decommissioned as they would in a standard procedure. The concern, as you mentioned earlier from a quote of the plant manager there, is if there were to be another huge earthquake or a tsunami were to strike the facility again, then you're talking about a situation of total chaos. The odds of that, of course, are extremely tiny, but the odds of this happening like it did on March 11, 2011, were also considered to be very small, a kind of black swan event, as it turned out. So when we're talking about decades and decades, it is the world's most seismically active area, and there is always the possibility of a large quake, maybe not magnitude 9 again so soon in geological time, but magnitude 7, magnitude 8 definitely. And when you have accidents, usually it's not just one thing going wrong, but a few things going wrong. So we're basically faced with the situation that we have to have trust in Tokyo Electric Power Company to keep things under control. And of course, I think if you were to take a survey both in and out of Japan, there wouldn't be a lot of trust in TEPCO.
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong? What has come? We got just a few more minutes here with Steve Herman. What has come of the nuclear rod since you mentioned how precarious things are? I'm reminded of the nuclear rods that were precariously stored in an above-ground tank. I think it was reactor number 4, if I'm remembering it correctly. Have those rods now been safely moved and stored elsewhere at this point? Or are they still sort of precariously balanced up there as they were in the days after the quake?
Yeah, the fuel rods were removed from the spent fuel pool at reactor 4. That was back in, 2014?
Mm-hmm.
But you have a total of more than 1,500 fuel rod assemblies out there, and most of those are deemed at risk, and they were transferred to other buildings. So, again, as long as there is not some sort of cataclysmic earthquake and tsunami again that were to, destroy the entire site, that is one of among a number of worries there. We're looking at with reactor 1, the spent fuel pool rods are supposed to be removed, I believe, next year. But that is going to be more challenging as time goes on here.
Former Prime Minister Naoto Kan sort of echoed your comments by saying that the nuclear accident is still going on today. There are concerns about those rods even now. But finally, and he, by the way, I should say, is actually protesting the reopening of the nuclear plants. He told the Telegraph that there is a clear conflict between government policy and the wishes of the public. Additional protective measures against tsunamis have been taken, like raising protective walls, he said, but I don't think they go far enough, and we shouldn't be building nuclear plants in areas where there is a population to be affected. After the tsunami, he said, Japan went without nuclear power for years, so it can be done. But the current prime minister clearly has another idea. Steve, finally, what has become of those people? I recall there was a skeleton crew who were asked to remain, actually ordered to remain at the plant during the peak of the crisis. As I recall, at the time, there were people who were elderly. They decided they had lived a good life and that they were willing to take risk their lives to protect the rest of the nation. Have there been deaths since that time directly related to the people working on the maintenance of those plants? Have those people survived, or have we lost a lot of them at this point?
Well, there was a plant manager who did die of cancer, but it was believed that, not that that was necessarily a pre-existing condition, but you couldn't definitively say that he died of cancer because of radiation exposure from the plant, because he died after quite a short time. As far as I know, I have not seen any credible reporting, and as you can imagine, there is a lot of scrutiny on Fukushima, mm-hmm. not only by the government, but a lot of independent scientists around the world, and there are not, at this point, any deaths that have been directly attributed to high levels of radiation exposure from being on site at the accident itself. Obviously, you know, as I mentioned, we have one worker who in a year got 678 millisieverts of exposure. That's very concerning. And then, of course, there's been a huge controversy about examination of thyroids of children who were living there at the time. And most scientists will tell you, you really need to look at decades of data before you can see any sort of trends to make some conclusions about whether there has been an increase in cancers or deaths from this accident. So again, just as the cleanup's going to take decades, I think it may be decades before we're going to have any definitive data about the human toll from the radiation itself.
Steve Herman in Bangkok, where he is the bureau chief for Voice of America News. You can check out his work. You can and should check it out at voanews.com. And I would argue, as importantly, on the Twitters, because he is a really good... Steve, I think you were nominated for a Shorty Award for your reporting on Twitter, if I recall. His Twitter handle is W7VOA. And I have found you to be an invaluable resource there over the years, Steve, as, you know, one quake hits and another and, you know, any number of news items coming out of Japan and Asia. So good to talk to you 5 years on after Fukushima. And go ahead and just pencil it into your book. We'll give you a call on the 10-year anniversary. And I suspect the exact same mess may still be going on 5 years from now.
Brad, I think we would be having a very similar conversation 5 years from now.
All right, well, I'll just do a rerun and take the day off on the 10th anniversary.
good.
Thank you, Stephen. Stephen L. Herman from Voice of America News. Thank you, my friend.
My pleasure.
All right, we're late, so a quick break, and we are back with more Bradcast right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Fascinating and troubling interview there with Steve Herman.
Yes, indeed. Especially the part where, you know, the Japanese taxpayer is going to have to foot the bill for the entire thing for the next several decades.
Yeah, and of course, that would be the same exact thing if it happened here in this country, where we are still using the same type of nuclear plants that that they're using in Japan.
Yeah, and most people are not aware that here in the United States, there was actually a law that was passed several decades ago that makes that limits the liability of the nuclear industry in case of an accident so that they could get insurance. And if there is an accident, the insurance covers something like, you know, $75 million, but the billions after that are all covered by the U.S. taxpayer.
So a bailout in advance.
Yes, if anything that's exactly goes wrong. What we have done.
They get the profits. We get to pay for the cleanup.
Well, in other words, because Wall Street is not willing to back up any kind of nuclear plant, so that's why the taxpayer has to do it. We're the ones that do that.
All right, just to leave folks with some good news, that's the least we can do here. The Vermont Secretary of State tweeted a little bit earlier today that by 137-0 vote, the Vermont House has passed automatic voter registration.
Wow.
So good news for Vermonters if that continues and is signed into law, as I suspect it will be. Add them to Oregon and California out here who are all moving towards automatic voter registration. Take away the difficulty of participating in your democracy at all, as it should be. So there's some good news. We'll leave you with that. You're welcome. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, to Steve Herman of VOA News for his fantastic work out there. Always good to speak with him. If you missed any portion of today's program and my interview with Steve about Fukushima, you can download it for free at bradblog.com as ever, as all of our shows, as well as over at iTunes, where I hope you will subscribe for free. So you easily get each and every day's show. And while you're over there, give us a good review. It'll make it a little bit easier for the rest of the world to find the work that we are doing here at on the Bradcast and over at bradblog.com. You can drop me email if you like on any of this. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And you can and should follow me on the Twitters and the Facebooks. And share like crazy. I am the Brad Blog over there. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.